Today on ABCDTOS, for the world is hollow and I have touched the sky.
Welcome back, everybody, to ABCDTOS. This is the show where we discuss every single episode of the original series of Star Trek in alphabetical order, all the way from All Our Yesterdays to Wolf in the Fold. My name is Tom Taylor. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? I'm John Engel.
Nice to meet you. I'm Joe Mazel.
Gentlemen, I'm Pete the Retailer. Oh, and listeners, I'm also Pete the Retailer.
And today you are here to listen to us discuss not only For the World is Hollow, but also I Have Touched the Sky.
What? Yeah,
special two-part episode, I'm guessing from the title.
It's like a double A-side.
I like how much smaller the font got for this title, of this episode on the show.
Almost didn't make it.
It's For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. It's, depending on who you're asking, season 3, episode 8, which is the Netflix broadcast order, or season 3, episode 10, which is production order. And it originally aired, November 8th, 1968. According to Google, here's the plot. Kirk decides to take a landing party to investigate when a huge number of missiles hurtle towards the Enterprise, seemingly from a deserted asteroid with a mysterious hollow center. It's also a delicious hollow center.
Probably was. Hey, let me just say real quick, we'll get right to second number one of this episode. I love incoming, like something is incoming, and I love Red Alert, like right away.
Nice shot from Red Alert, the light right to Spock's head. That's pretty cool.
To blue, cold as ice Spock. It's like red, red hot alert, cold as ice Spock. I like that little move.
Red Alert, Schmed Alert.
There's a funny, it's a funny gag there because he's like, do we have maximum magnification, Lieutenant? And it's like an optically zoomed in shot. You could tell it's grainy, kind of like zoomed in on his face. And so it's like, do we have maximum magnification, Lieutenant? And I could see
we seem to.
Like Sulu's there with like a Steenback being like, all right, got it. Hang on. I had a question. Before this episode, I was worried. This is not a question. It's a dumb joke. I was worried about...
The question isn't who put the bop in my bop shawap dwop.
No. We figured that out.
Okay.
Just the same guy.
Love?
Wait, yeah, the same guy who did put the ram in the ramalama ding dong.
Ah, okay.
But who was that man? Hands. I don't know who either of those men were. I still haven't figured it out.
My dumb question was, will I be able to understand this episode if I haven't seen one, The World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, through three, The World is Hollow and I Haven't Touched the Sky? That was my dumb joke. Then we'll I had see. Another more serious question.
Okay.
When they first, the missiles are coming towards them and they're like, and they're like, you know, what's the deal with the missiles? And Spock is like, oh, they're very, primitive, sublight speed. And I'm like, what? If they were faster than light missiles, I think we would have more of a problem. We wouldn't have time to sit around and talk about it. They would would have been like, what was that hit us 20 minutes ago?
Right. Light speed missiles, you don't even know. You don't know about those, right? Those are... You know about those after you're floating out into space.
Right.
There are a lot of mentions of how old-fashioned and janky this awesome generational starship thing is. It's like, it runs on atomic... gross chemical. Chemicals that pollute the whole galaxy. It's disgusting. There's a big brown trail coming out behind it. It's just sick. But I mean, you think really, does that even work? Could you build a cool ship that looks like an asteroid on the outside and on the inside it's got a creamy center of people that have been there for thousands and thousands of years?
This is a question. I'm not smart enough to know this, but so the missiles were the chemically, that's what Scotty goes, and chemically powered or fueled or whatever, right?
Right.
So that's like gasoline. The ship itself isn't, though. This has got to have some kind of an atomic nuclear reactor in it or something.
I think they did say, right? They said atomic.
I feel like they did.
They might have. Yeah, you're probably right.
Once they get closer. I think the missiles, were rocket fuel.
Right, right, right.
I mean, it's not diesel, but it's also not warp drive or something.
Yeah, I got a little confused because you're talking about brown. You're basically talking about it spewing exhaust like an old Buick. And I was like, were they saying that it was gas powered? Because where'd they get the gas? Where'd they fuel up on that thing?
They it was old fashioned to their from their point of view.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said it was like it was leaving a trail of hard radiation and something else. I forgot what the other. Yeah, it's not. It is like an old junker.
Mm.
Like an old junker.
It's like an old RV.
Ship.
It's like it's like the RV from
the Winnebago
Starship or something. Yeah.
But yes, then they are attacked by missiles. They get kind of temporarily distracted by that. They just blow them up, and it's like, all right, cool, I'm back to normal. But it's not back to normal because we see there's something going on in the sick bay. Mm. Nurse Chapel is very upset.
Mm-hmm. She is.
Sad Chapel. That was my note. Sad Chapel.
Yeah. And why is she upset? Xenopolycythemia.
Wow, you wrote it down.
Xenopolycythemia?
Better man than I.
I thought it was a V, but you might be right. Xenopolycythemia.
I heard Xeno,
Which then immediately set Karma Chameleon through my head since I heard it. I've been singing Xeno. Anyway.
I have it. I have the memory alpha in front of me. Apparently, this isn't the only time that they've used it.
Oh.
It came up in, of course, because... Like, Enterprise seems to be largely constructed from people who apparently didn't watch Star Trek but read Memory Alpha, and so they used it twice apparently, or at least mentioned it in Enterprise.
Hmm.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Once when Captain Archer was kidnapped and put on trial by the Klingon Empire, Dr. Phlox told them that Archer had xenopolycythemia. A ruse that allowed him to meet with the captain. And then also, at some point, a sample of the disease's pathogen was stored at Cold Station 12 in the Enterprise episode, Cold Station 12.
Can't wait till we get around to that show.
Well, we can talk about how the impending death of Dr. McCoy serves this episode or not, but it is too bad that partly because it serves as like the stinger of the prologue, whatever. And then when we come back from the titles and commercials, we're like in the middle of, trying to figure out the asteroid thing and everything. Kirk never gets a chance through this entire episode to really be like, oh my God, Bones is dying. Like, oh no. We deal with it a little bit later on. And there's some conversation about it. And Spock gets a nice moment. But like Kirk never really gets to react to that. And it's a little frustrating.
Yeah, like you would think, going back to, even in season two, like, like the way that the reaction between the two, like when Spock thought he killed Kirk or something like that, you should have a moment of like, oh, my friend is dying. That's no good. Like,
yeah, even in like he mentions it in passing in the captain's log. And like, even then he could be like, he could be reflecting on that. Like, it's my job as the captain to figure out this stupid asteroid thing, but damn it, my friend's dying. I've known this guy for years. This blows.
I have to say, I'd hate to story conference a 50-year-old episode of television.
That's what we're here for.
That's kind of what we do here.
Perhaps this episode would have been stronger if the focus was on let's find a cure for my friend's incurable disease and not, well, you're going to die. Anyway, back to the asteroid.
Oh, well, because I see it as more Bones is making choices based on the fact that he's going to die. It's not so the episode doesn't need to be about that exactly. It just needs to inform Bones as a character. So I don't think it's wasted by any means. It's just they could have gone that direction, but they didn't. But I don't think it's left behind and forgotten. Bones is playing off of it all the time.
I'm not going to deny that. It's just as I said, it seems like. It seems like the episode's a little bit too top heavy and what they're doing, what
right.
Bones's illness seems to, I don't know if it's necessarily necessary to the episode working. In some way, I'm not saying it's completely wasted, but there are stronger ways to deal with that, deal with it, and it feels to me like they could have done stronger things with it. There.
Well,
I've said it circularly, and I stand by my circle.
Yes, I partially agree, but not in the... I don't think it should be discarded. I think it's an important part of the, you know, the way that the flow of the episode, the story, you know, it's like, oh, that's why he decides to stay, because he has nothing. He's going to die anyway, so he's going to...
Mm-hmm.
And that's what allows the whole thing to unfold. But then, basically, they I think they should have committed to it, and then it, like, my main, again, skipping all the way to the end, my main problem with it is that, like, then at the end, it's just like, oh, what's that behind your ear? The cure for polycythemia, you know, xenopolycythemia. Like, it's just like, well, what? You almost tripped over it on the way out. Like, and that's, and then it's like, everything's back to normal. It's like, like, that, you know, if they could have, even if it was like, you know, like a better thing would have been like, oh, well, that, you know, like when he first becomes indoctrinated, they could be like, oh, well, no, that the, you know, the maybe the little reminder of obedience or whatever it is, the little thing that they put in his temple. Maybe they could have had a sub note.
The COVID like, vaccine. Oh. Am I right, guys?
What?
Yeah. Yeah, man.
Yeah. You know, the thing that the so they can track him. No, they like maybe, you know, just at the end, throw in a thing like, oh, no, well, when that goes in you, it. You know, it keeps you healthy. It cures all of your things. Some like little throwaway that like, oh, it's a side effect, not just kind of like, oh, hey, look, as we're leaving, by the way, do anybody need these cures for the disease that is the crux of your story arc in this episode?
Clobber cures your things. Hey,
I
once
thought
an episode,
for sure,
whether you need it or not.
Right. I thought for sure what I was thinking, because I did not have much of a memory of this episode. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought somehow the Oracle was going to use, like, ultra zap technology. Like, he was going to do the ultimate one on Bones for betraying her or something, whatever reason. And that was going to do it. Like, it was going to be as close to death as you can come. They pull him out of it. And somehow that was going to, you know, it's all convenient. I don't think there was much of a way to get around it without being convenient sci-fi. Well, we needed a solution.
I think, like, there's two big things that happen to Bones in this. One, he finds out he's going to die. And the other one is that he falls in love with somebody.
Yeah, that's another big one.
He's like, so, like, Bones, I mean,
you could do without, I mean, you could lose the whole death thing. You could lose the fact that he's died. The whole reason the death thing is there is so that he decides to stay on the asteroid with the nice lady. But that could just be because, like, he's got a few moments where he's like, oh my God, I've been really lonely for a really long time. My life has been really empty. And he finds this woman, like, and he's like, oh my gosh, I could be happy here. I could, it would be huge. It'd be like turning his back on his friends and his duty and everything, but still that could be there without him. It's easy. I see you're shaking your head, John. And it is easier with him dying. Thing, like, he's got nothing else. But since the death thing is handled, so you know, he's not going to die from the very beginning time. From the moment you hear
his name is in the credits,
but I can see, you know, I can see this, you know, so if this is, you know, halfway through season three, where you know that you barely got a season three, and all of a sudden, you know, he's like, you know what, I'm going to stay behind. You could be like, oh, maybe, you know, like they,
right.
They could very well just, you know, be like slowly shedding cast members here.
Yeah.
But we've also spent 2.5 seasons drilling into the audience's minds that loyalty to the Enterprise, to Captain Kirk, is paramount to everything, no pun intended. And
it's Desi Lu.
Bones needs an extra push. He needs something else. He can't just decide that just because he falls in love. And they've all fallen in love from time to time. I mean, Spock had the extra thing. You know, we'll see. You know, we saw before, but the audience would see later. There's an extra thing there. Well, first of all, they think they're trapped on the other planet. And man, I've forgotten the name of that episode. And
All Our Yesterdays.
All Our Yesterdays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
And for Bones, there's no way Bones is going to drop the Enterprise and Kirk just because he fell in love with this lady. I think the fact that, well, I'm not going to be able to serve you anyway, and they even make the point to have the exposition of there's another doctor on the way. Mm-hmm. So we already have it planted in our minds that he's about to be replaced sooner than the year anyway. Mm-hmm. Gives him a reason to go to reevaluate himself. I mean, that's going to make him more vulnerable to falling in love.
Yeah.
To me, it
and that does
it
work
all.
To a point. That does work to a point where he's like, "I'll, you know, whatever time left I got, I'm going to spend it here mm-hmm. with this nice lady on this nice rock. It's going to be really yeah. good." And it starts off clumsy because you want that reaction from Kirk and you never get it. And it ends clumsy. Like it starts to like just get weirder and weirder as the episode goes on, the way they handle it.
Well,
it could have been more deftly. Those two story arcs could have met more deftly, I mm-hmm. think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And going all the way back to where we started with this, I think you guys are right. There should have been a moment where we get Kirk's feelings on the subject, and they really had an opportunity there when he confides in Spock that Bones is dying. We got a great opportunity for emotional Kirk and logical Spock to have a heartfelt conversation and get yeah. the play off of that we always love to get, where Spock says something that doesn't quite jibe with emotional thinking.
Yeah.
But Kirk knows how to get things off his chest to him anyway. And even mm-hmm. Bones could have overheard it and woken up, and then we get the three of them, and it would be a great classic, you know, mm-hmm. what do they call it? The triad of Star Trek.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I think that would have fueled the episode more. I think that we needed to stop and refuel that plot line and that yeah. theme. And they didn't quite get that done. So that might have fixed a lot of the problems you guys are having with the episode.
Well, I mean, I think that goes back to my note is written by some guy, directed by some other guy. Because it's like, yeah, this could have used a little, like, you know, Gene Kuhn and Joseph Pevney or something like that, yep. or DC mm-hmm. Fontana, Joseph Pevney. But instead, it's written by Rick Valerichs and directed by Tony Leader. Leader?
You say so.
I thought it was Leader.
Rick Valerichs was a TV writer. This is his only Star Trek episode. He knew Roddenberry back from working on Mr. District Attorney in the 50s. And then
it'd be funny if that was literally his last name, but he was actually like a gas station attendant.
There's that kid in the hall about that. Yeah. Just because I'm a district attorney doesn't mean that my name is Mr. District Attorney. I might have that backwards, actually.
So yeah, he didn't. They eventually, he was like, he was interested when they needed a new story editor for 30 seasons. He didn't get hired for that, but instead they were just like, well, what kind of stories you got? And so he they bought one of them, and this one is it.
This is a really solid science fiction idea. I mean, it's been done a bunch of times, and it's always kind of cool.
I think the main thing is that it just needs another pass of Star Trek. And I think if this same script was produced in season two, it would have been, you know, mm-hmm. it has potential to be like a top tier episode, because it's just so, it needs that little, the goo. It needs the Star Trek, you know.
It's the goo.
Yeah.
It needs the goo.
Space
goo. There's a gooey center there. It's just not the right kind of goo.
People.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
We should keep beating that joke to death.
Like the episode itself, it's all surface. Tony Leader or Letter, I don't know. Leader is the only one that he directed. Although he directed two Twilight Zone episodes.
One called "For the World Was Hollow" and the other called "So I've Touched the Sky."
Yeah, it's kind of combination of those two.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find the ones that he did. He did a bunch of. The Virginian, two episodes of Get Smart, House of Max, parts 1 and 2. Six episodes of Gilligan's Island.
Oh, boy. Say no more.
Yeah. And I'm trying to find the other, Twilight Zone, Midnight Sun, and Long Live Walter Jameson.
That was actually the original title for the AC/DC song, and then they just sort of just didn't roll off the tongue, so they changed it to Long Live.
Then he did, you know, he did a bunch of the kind of standard kind of stuff that you did around this time.
Mm-hmm.
Ironside.
How many episodes of Mannix?
I don't see any Mannix. I was looking for like...
None of us have seen any Mannix either.
I just got my first season today. I haven't all watched.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow.
It was $8. What
turned your back on
do?
The club. The non-Mannix club.
Basically
trying to grow as a person.
All right, show off.
I think we hit the heart of it, that if it's this, you know, there's some good concepts in here. Some of it's been done, you know, obviously in sci-fi before, but also in Star Trek before a little bit. But if you have potential, it's worked well into a Star Trek plot, but it needs a little more Star Trek mm-hmm. on it.
I actually was pretty confused by the ship itself. I that was one, like, even though I was like, I was on this thing's side for like the first, you know, half hour or something, but I was distracted by how little I understood the concept of the ship. That, well,
yeah,
you know, it, I get that people have been on the ship for 10,000 years or whatever it is, and are they not supposed to go to this? Are they? They know they're inside a thing. We find out later that the race that they are descended from lived underground at the end because there mm-hmm. there was some sort of cataclysm going on. Mm-hmm. And so, but are they thinking that they are, how do I even say that? Like, it seems like nobody ever goes to the surface and they're not supposed to know that there is a surface, like an outside.
Right.
Which is still in the middle of the asteroid.
Yeah,
somehow,
like when they beam down to that surface, when they beam down to the surface, which somehow has light sourcing in it, even yeah. though it is inside of an asteroid,
is that
it? Still a secondary level? That's how yeah. I understood it.
Also, when they beam down, you see them, and it looks, it's dirt and like hills yeah. and stuff. Yeah. That right. is not the outside of the asteroid.
My understanding no. is no.
Okay, no, no, now no. I get it. That There's was unclear, but
like
I get it.
Shell around that.
All right, because Which the guy was talking about, like, oh, I climbed the mountain and I touched right. the thing and stuff. I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, wait, but is the mountain like the stairs that we saw
I
them come down?
I believe what he said is, for the world is hollow and I touch the sky. Come on, man.
Yeah.
I don't
he did,
know.
He did say he went know. Into the mountain.
I know,
I got
I know.
Confused, too.
I just wanted to repeat this title because it's so eloquent.
it's, you know, of all the episodes, if you showed me a list of all the episode titles of Star Trek, which you know you have done. We have that in front of us.
we have a big long list.
It's part
and
of
you
our
were
job.
Like, all right, you know, pick the ones of these in which they say the title of the episode twice. I would not have picked this one.
not only twice, but basically twice in a row.
Yeah, more
yeah,
or less.
Really close together.
Did he say yeah. for the world is hollow and I yeah. have touched the sky?
Yeah.
Yes, Captain. He did say for the world is hollow and I have touched the sky.
Holy
wait,
smokes.
Wait. Hold on. Let me ask you one more time.
What a weird old man. Wait,
so I think on the, you know, to wrap up the discussion of how this asteroid is made up, we could describe it a bit like a double-layered taco, right, from Taco Bell. Like, it's
oh,
got
sure.
a soft tortilla, taco? Double-decker, thank you. I don't actually eat Taco Bell, really, but but I remember a soft tortilla with a little bit of refried beans mm-hmm. attached to a hard-shell taco mm-hmm. filled with a gooey center.
Okay,
I just went right. gooey center just to say that again. But no, meat and
a taco-y center.
Yeah, so the people are the taco.
It's probably gooier than you want it yeah. to think about.
The people are the taco filling. The hard shell is the what they think to be the surface of their planet. Right. The beans
the
are kind
beans.
Of the mountains.
Yeah.
And then the soft shell soft is the okay. God, exterior
hungry.
Of the asteroid.
So if it's so a hungry. Supreme... Then what is the sour cream?
The sour cream is the what is
the Mary Wells and or Diana Ross of it.
right. Good point.
No, it's the what's the word? Not the icon. What's the
oracle?
Thing called?
The bird.
Oracle.
The bird is.
Oh, the oracle's the sour cream.
The okay. oracle's the sour cream. I'm assuming. And the
oracle,
book.
Barbara.
The book.
Gordon,
the book is one of those little tomato cubes. And then I just want to go as far as I can go with the Taco yeah. Bell analogy.
Right.
Okay, but this is what messed me up.
More a seven layer.
Seven
be.
Layer. Oh, let's
talk they don't really make
layer.
Those anymore. Seven layer. Oh, you can't really
that,
get a seven.
Well, that doesn't mean that that's not a suitable analogy though.
That's true.
See, that's weird because when they show the exterior of the asteroid from space, it looks like an asteroid with craters and rocks and stuff. And the way you're describing it, which I think you guys are right, but it should be like a smooth dome or something of the sky or something, the outside of the sky. I don't know.
Mm. Or well, that's the thing. They can't get to. It's like an artificial sky inside the thing.
Yeah, but you should see the outside of that artificial sky. You know, like a shell.
I got
like
a sky inside.
There's
me.
A physical hard shell that is the sky. It's like if you know, the chocolate syrup that you put on the ice cream. It's like the ship is the ice cream, but then the sky is the hard shell
the
that freezes
shell?
On top of the
yeah.
thing. Yeah, the chocolate
the
shell. Thank
shell?
You, Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe Pete would understand better. We said the cherry shell.
The cherry dip kind of thing.
Hey, yeah. Butterscotch,
doesn't understand chocolate
shell.
Analogies.
Butterscotch magic shell is delicious.
Okay. the cherry magic shell, which I believe, Pete, you introduced me to, is quite a delight.
It really
Joe,
is.
Joe, this is cherry magic shell. Magic shell, this is Joe.
When Pete and I worked retail,
they dated for a while.
The summers would be an ice cream truck, like, parked outside the
Right,
room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the cherry dip. Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Totally go. Oh, man. White, soft.
We had some good times.
Soft vanilla cherry dip with nuts.
Yes.
There you go.
Oh my God. Is it summer yet?
Why are we are talking about food a lot on this episode?
Well, someone decided Taco Bell would be the perfect analogy. So.
Well, it was. It turned out it was.
Let me bring it back. Here's something that's not food.
Spock. Brulee?
Oh, no. Spock is not food. I am not food. That was his autobiography, right?
That was his third book. First it was I am not Spock. Then it was I am Spock. Then he thought about it and said, you know what? I'm not food either.
By the way. He was actually going to write a series of books about all the things he wasn't.
Yeah.
It was going to be very, very long.
I am not.
He is a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll. Go figure.
That's true. Wow. But by that same token, he is also not a little bit country and not a little bit rock and roll.
Yes.
It's like his Vulcan side and his human side.
It's like four more books. How did this guy find the time?
And he directed, was it the movie with Diane Keaton? Was it like Finding Your Mother or whatever it was called?
Your Mother.
I know that one.
It was the not Star Trek one. It was a kind of, I wouldn't say a big hit at the time, but it was sort of a prestige film.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think it was called
Finding Out That Your Mother Is Not Spock. That's what it was called.
I remember the Little Baby
three men and
movies.
A baby? Yeah.
He did Three Men and a Little Baby and Three Men and a Little Lady.
Three non-Vulcans and a not Spock.
anyway,
Keaton.
One thing that Spock does here is he asks, oh no, it's Kirk. Sorry, Kirk. Kirk is a jerk. Kirk asks Spock to double-check Chekhov's work in front of Chekhov. They get there, and he's like, Mr. Spock, can you double-check this guy's work to make sure that the sensor readings are correct? And Spock was like, that's cool.
That's
like,
what they call
counter-argument,
good.
A very important counter-argument. Can you blame him? Have you seen Chekhov in action? Come on.
I'm telling you, they call him Chekhov because he always had to check his work.
Yeah, it's not even his name. Yeah.
Old Chekhov, because he had to have that checklist. And anyway.
My name is Gogol, sir. You'd stop calling me Chekhov.
The Good Mother. That was the movie I was thinking
of.
Oh, yeah.
Your Mother.
I recognize that name.
With Diane Keaton, Liam Neeson, Jason Robards, and Ralph Bellamy.
Wow, what a cast.
Oh, my God. James Naughton and Teresa Wright are in it? This is crazy.
Teresa Wright and Ralph Bellamy are on this movie. That's crazy. And it was on TCM every Saturday afternoon.
Wait, I realize I'm still confused about
this ship. This is like, might be the king of all movies.
I'm still confused about this asteroid ship.
Okay.
Because I noticed what I thought was a really neat detail, but now it confuses me. They get down there, they have a fisticuffs and everything, they start to bring the guys down, and we can talk about the fisticuffs, but as they're leaving, the guards take out their swords and start spreading out the dirt covering up like the footprints and stuff, and I thought that was because if anybody does make it up here, they should see that no one has ever been up here. But what you guys are telling me makes it sound like no, sometimes people go up there, they just shouldn't, and they shouldn't climb the mountain because then they'll touch the sky and then the whole thing will be blown
right. Just the one guy went up there and he died saying so.
Not supposed to be up there, and so if somebody comes up there and they see that there are footprints, so, people have been up here, that would encourage, embolden the heretic to continue.
But if you're not supposed to be up there, then why put the asteroid surface on there? Who's it for?
Because eventually you're going to need to get off of there.
Yeah, I have a couple
couldn't
of
that just be like a ramp?
I have a couple of things I want to say about this scene, if you'll indulge me for a moment.
Please do.
Okay, what scene are we talking about?
Basically the second scene when they beam down to the planet.
The fight.
And,
the fight.
Okay, so
fight.
Number one, the little cylinder elevators, I believe, were stolen lock, stock, and barrel from Godzilla vs. Monster Zero. That's the one with the Devo aliens who live below the surface of the planet that King Ghidorah's on.
Sure.
And I think the timeline works out on that. The other thing is, and I hate to do this on some level, but the costumes were, it was like a 1971 hippie commune's, reenactment of Macbeth. It was the worst thing imaginable. Like, no, man, it should be like neon plaid.
get those get those leather trash cans, and we'll like kind of bend them on our heads.
Yeah, put some dots right. on them.
The best is when Kirk just kicks the crap out of that guy and his hat goes flying. Like, yeah. That's like the most violent thing ever on the original series, I think, was that
I think he killed
kick.
That guy.
It's funny that you said that. It's like, oh, these guys are the ugliest costumes I've ever seen, where my note was like, hey, they look like the I looked in high school. Whereas, I used to wear two clashing plaids all the time, like a double flannel.
Oh, nice.
or like a flannel with the plaid cutoff pants, like the ugliest pants I could find with a contrasting plaid flannel. Whoa. And so they totally do. They look like a 90s. Yeah. Like they look
and
like
to
a,
my point, it's not something you wear now.
Oh, no.
I don't want my wife to kill me in my sleep.
What does the, when they're then taken, we got a weird, I didn't quite get it at first until the rest of the plot unfolded. I was like, why is McCoy staring at that woman and why is she staring back? Like, what's going on?
He freezes.
Am I missing something? Yeah. Is this because, is he dying right now?
Like, right. I thought
dying
she literally done
with
something
desire.
To him.
Like,
she hit him with a thunderclap, guys.
Yeah.
I guess so. Sometimes you just take a beat to make sure the audience knows that love just happened. Yeah. We only have 45 minutes to 50 minutes to establish a full love story that gets all the way to marriage. Just have them fall in love at first sight and make sure the audience knows it.
I think I needed a spit take or something right then. I think during
you
the fight,
you
should have been
You needed Michael Corleone's Sicilian bodyguards in the first Godfather, and I can't remember the names for the life of me. Like, I think Nunzio is one of them. But they feed him with the thunderclap.
Yeah, exactly.
Her dad should have come out and talked to them and find out they were talking about her and get all pissed off. Yeah.
Or just like as they lock eyes and all of a sudden everything fades out and you hear Dreamweaver. Yeah. There you go.
Perfect.
And then bam, he's
Wayne's World or The Godfather. I think they're both of equal cinematic quality and should be regarded in the same tier.
Tomato, exactly. Tomato.
I'd like to talk. So since we're on the subject, let's talk about, I believe her name was Nutella, correct?
Wait,
I want to call her Nutella.
Not Nutella.
I did want to call her Nutella. There's no doubt, but I think it was Nutella. I kind of fell in love with her as this episode went along.
She's good.
I kind of had an idea of what I thought she was going to be at the beginning.
Oh, Natira, that's why.
Natira.
Oh, okay.
Natira.
Well, then forget it.
So take a letter, Natira, bum, 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 and send it to my wife, bum, 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 bum.
Boy, that would be awkward. But she is
Tell
like,
her I'm staying on this asteroid.
She is like a
I got to start a new life.
She's a solid lady.
Yeah.
She's like...
She is like, not gaseous at all.
Not at all. She is solid 100% flesh and bone. No, she's just... Everything she does, I'm like, she's pretty cool, actually. It sucks that she's brainwashed and she's doesn't know better than this. Mm-hmm. But she even when Kirk confronts her and it's like, okay, you're going to have to believe me about this. She comes around in kind of a natural way. Like, I can understand.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be a full-on, she'll never believe him, and they were going to have to do something more drastic. But she starts to realize, even with the Bill Gates device in her temple, she started to come around. And I was like, man, I like this lady. I think she's pretty cool.
And I didn't remember her. She didn't stick out in my memory of all the Star Trek supporting characters and stuff at all. But, she was a nice surprise this time.
Yeah, and if somebody just came up to me and like I wrote, if all of a sudden somebody's like, listen, you've got to believe me. Like, there's ancient aliens and they live under the Himalayas. I would be like,
sure,
whatever.
No, but, like, you have to believe. It keeps grabbing you when you try.
Yeah, exactly.
To
You know, it's a funny thing. As John, you mentioned your love of Nutella. I was thinking like, oh man, you know what would be a kind of fun idea if you do something like a Star Trek show, but it's more like just guys traveling across the people traveling across the country in, I don't know, like a Winnebago or something, and they stumble on an evangelical and they're basically trying to convince them that, you know, their Bible's a lie to James Kirk. And I was like, oh man, that would be cool. And then I was like, wait a minute, that's basically the plot of the movie Paul. So really, everybody watch Paul. It's kind of a fun movie.
Paul's a fun movie. Yeah. I recommend it.
Haven't seen it.
You should. Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and not Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Nick Frost.
Yeah. And Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, really?
Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, Seth Rogen as the alien.
Seth Rogen's the alien and Blythe Danner.
Yes, Blythe Danner has a significant part in it. Yeah,
Mrs. Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, senior.
So,
Gwyneth, it's a fun little movie.
Do you, I was looking up the so our Catherine Woodville.
Woodville
sounds made up, yeah. But Catherine Woodville, plays Nutella here, and she did like a bunch of the standard things from the 60s and 70s, and then just like stopped.
Retired.
But she was on, here's your Mannix. She was on an episode of two episodes of Mannix. She played Joanna Salt and Vera Rollins.
How many episodes of Mission Impossible?
I didn't see any Mission Impossible. There's some Rockford Files.
Of course.
It looks like she did a run on Days of Our Lives.
I noticed that, yeah.
Did she go out on Love Boat? Was that her last? I wanted to say that I remember Love Boat.
No, she did Eight Is Enough.
Eight Is Enough, that was it.
I believe that will fill my life with love.
It is enough.
She did two episodes as Mrs. Chovic, Ms. Chovic on Eight Is Enough.
Each day like bright and then that's shiny new dimes.
And then it's not like she died in like 1980. She just like stopped.
Did something else.
Well,
and here's
we could talk about why that happens sometimes to women in Hollywood.
True.
Weirdly.
That's a lot of people's careers end right about then, unfortunately.
Her birth name was Catherine Woodville with a C, and her professional name is Catherine Woodville with a K.
It just sounds better. It's like Steve Ditko. It just kind of pops with you.
It's probably a SAG thing. If there's another Catherine Woodville with a C in SAG, you got to change it to something else.
I guess.
Happens all the time.
I don't know.
No, it's an absolute. Yeah, if you're in the guild, you can't have the same name as another person.
I know, but like, people change even if names. It sounds exactly the same, like you can just change a letter and.
Yeah, it's all for their paperwork. They don't want to send checks to the wrong people and stuff.
Yeah. She was married three times. Once was to Patrick McNee. That was her first marriage.
She should have married the rest of him too.
And
not
then,
just his Irish
that got
knee.
The appropriate degree of laughter. I salute my terrible joke, but I also salute your response.
And then she was married to Edward Albert, the son of Eddie Albert.
Wow. So Eddie Albert.
Well, Edward. Right. Yes. And
if he's the son, he's the Eddie. Isn't that the automatic case?
Yeah.
You would think.
Little Eddie.
He could be the Ebtide if he's the son.
That's true.
Man, but, yeah, and then...
I'm cooking with gas tonight.
And then she just retired in 1979. That's it. Mm-hmm. And then died in 2013.
Wow.
Just I'm done.
Sometimes it gets harder to get work. Sometimes you decide you want to stay home.
But yeah, it looks like they got married... She got married to Edward Albert in 1978 or so.
So he
maybe
goes,
that's.
Don't worry, honey. My career is going to take off, and you're not going to have to work another day.
I'm Edward Albert.
Eddie Albert. Look at me. I'm Eddie Albert. I'll be on the Green Acres reunion show. Greener Acres. Wait, there was one, wasn't there? Wasn't there?
I'm sure.
Probably. You know. With the Globetrotters or something. Yeah.
Edward Albert was on. Deep Space
We're
Nine
so
at one point.
Sorry.
Oh, really?
So they have like
Edward
a little
Albert.
Anyway.
But you don't get to have a career.
But you're not going to be on Green Acres.
Anyway, there's another star. Well, star. Quote unquote star. Another actor in this was John Lormer.
And this is something I wanted to talk about briefly.
Do you? John Lormer?
Well, not John Lormer per se, but one thing I've noticed about Star Trek, like watching Star Trek in this go around, and I thought of it after Aaron DeMercy, the last episode we did in regard to John Calicos, there was such a deep bench of just good television character actors.
Yeah.
Guys who overall or maybe late in their career never really had a reoccurring role, but just could be there and deliver the goods. And yeah, like John Lormer, you look at his career, it's insane how much television he did. And throughout this whole podcast, we've just like pointed out actors and actresses who just, yes, they have 375 credits and were on every TV show you could possibly think of that came out between the Kennedy administration and the Carter administration.
Yeah. And you get the sense they were all pals with each other. They all knew each other from like New York theater or something.
Yeah.
Or they all ate in the commissary together, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, how many shows were shot on the same lot? And
I always always think that when I watch like the Twilight Zone or something, or you know, anything from this whole era, like this 20 or 30 years, like, gosh, that must have been a great time to be an actor. You'd be just constantly working.
Yeah.
And, you know, good Jack people, Klugman. Too. Yeah, Jack Klugman. Or, like, granted, eventually, you know, he became sort of a branded as an icon with Jaws. But, like, Murray Hamilton is in, like, 1,000 things before he plays the mayor of Jaws. Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
What was his name again? John Lorman?
John Lormer.
John Lormer in Columbo. Just had to mention it.
There you go. I was just trying to look it up in the back. Three.
Yeah, he's in Lady in Waiting, the great one with Oscar from $6 Million Man.
Yeah.
Susan Clark's his sister.
Richard Anderson, thank you very much.
Yes, one of the two Anderson, with Leslie Nielsen where he's not the killer.
Yeah, Leslie Nielsen and then Roger Thornhill's mom from North by Northwest.
Yeah.
It's the episode where she makes Columbo get her luggage out of the taxi. She thinks he's just some lowly, I don't know what she thought, like the gardener or something.
Yeah.
He's just obviously not
raincoats.
He's obviously not at her station, so he should get her luggage. And she tips him $10, I think. If I remember right.
Is this some wait, who are we talking about? Who is this in the episode, in our episode?
Well, he's the old man who touches the sky.
Philip Diller. That's what I
Okay.
Bravo, Mr. Engel. Bravo.
We want to hold on that theme.
Wow.
He's definitely wearing a Phyllis Diller male version.
Yeah.
Moo moo.
This guy's dear to my heart because he's in Creepshow. He's the old patriarch who gets killed and then comes back from the dead and kills everybody for his Father's Day cake.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Bless his heart.
He makes it. This is his third Star Trek appearance.
Yeah.
And that makes this unusual in that it's the only series episode to feature three actors who appeared in the cage. Not, of course, counting Menagerie, which just uses stuff from the cage. But
really?
Because it's got Spock and Majel Barrett as Christine Chapel, who was number one, but then because he was one of the old people on the colony,
yes,
when they arrive, and now here he is again, much
as an old person on a different colony. When exactly, they arrive.
And we'll see him again much later as an old person in a colony when they arrive,
when it's the red hour.
Oh my, is it red hour already?
So the name of the GUI centered asteroid is Yurnada. Is that correct? Or is that the
Yurnada what?
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was gonna say, because they're he said you're not of Yurnada to them, and I wanted him to say no, we're not
You're out of Yurnada.
Yonada.
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 Yonada. Yeah. No, we're not a
Yonada Yonadan. I'm a what?
There's some real good bit that could happen there that they glanced over.
Can I make a very petty observation about one of the Yonadians?
Sure.
There's a guy. I think it's a guy. There's a guy who, like, when they first come down the stairs and they're going to see the Oracle, there's a guy standing outside the door, and he looks exactly like David Johansen playing Finney's daughter from Court Martial. Which is, facially, he looks just like him, but he's got like a very girlish haircut, and he's wearing something that she would wear, and it's carry on.
And he asked Santa Claus if that was him.
He doesn't have to check it when he's...
For a second, I was picturing Buster Poindexter, and I was like, huh.
Yeah, that's the joke I made. I could have gone with the Hot, Hot, Hot or a New York Dolls song, but I decided to stick with Santa Claus.
It actually works with the New York Dolls. He's got a very feminine wardrobe going on.
Which, by the way, popular phrase that we should enact in every episode from this point on, stick it with Santa Claus.
We will do that, Joe.
I would hope so.
Anxious for the opportunity to do that. I have no idea why they don't do really a Santa
Put
Claus
it in the spreadsheet.
Episode. Man, how do they avoid doing a Santa Claus episode on Star Trek? That seems they would absolutely have done, like a little Santa Claus.
Red alert! Something's coming in. Captain, put it on screen, and it's just and Santa.
At the end, they're like, "Wait a minute!" But that
red alert, like, Captain, more like red and green alert, Captain. For it's the holidays.
But like, you know, they find some weird alien guy that they think is, you know, he's just like, you know, they think he's crazy, but then at the end they're like, wait a minute, like if he's in here,
could
that
it
means
be that he visited Earth and was Saint Nicholas,
or just visits every single year and just teleports a bunch of presents to every single house at the same instant, and that's how he does it.
Why is that cane leaning against the wall of the transporter?
Maybe I didn't do such a great thing after all.
Here's a technical note while we're at it, while we're being petty. They come down the stairs into the, after they get abducted from the planet surface. Everything is put neatly back into place. They don't leave any divots.
Yeah.
They get brought downstairs using the same spiral staircase from the empath, if you notice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, did I?
And there's a shot through the spiral staircase, which in theory I love, except it's handheld, which I hate. I'm like, what? No. If you're going to set up this nice, if you're going to paint a picture here, you're going to shoot through the staircase and make it look artistic, lock it down. Like, let us look at, don't be all wobbly behind the stairs.
Probably because you're guessing that they were being artistic, and I'm betting that they were trying to get a shot in real quick, and they couldn't even get the set up. Yeah. They're like, so obscure it with the stairs, let's frame them in between these, and just get the shot real quick.
Right. I have a note here that it's obscure comic book reference. I wrote they worship the Star Brand.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Oh.
Because when they first walk into the room and there's on the Oracle, there's a little star looking thing. The Star Brand has a little around it. Mm. So it's a little bit different, but it's another little star design thing.
Well, this is definitely
you're a bigger new universe fan than I.
Mm.
Was that's the Star Brand we were talking about?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I just made it into the Star Brand, made it into the regular universe at some point. I think it merged with Nova, became part of the Nova mythology, I think. But anyway.
Well, so the big villain in this episode, which is perfectly in line with season 3, is a wall. It's just a wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
With a thing on it. It's the villain. And that's just like really keeping in the budgetary restrictions of season 3. It's like, who's the villain? I don't know. Get a good voice and then just have a wall blink or something. I don't know.
Again, it doesn't seem like they need more than that in the story. I'm like, they pick the story because they can make it cheaply. You know what I mean? Like that's
I'm for it. It's just funny.
It's totally obviously. Oh yeah, that's why they bought this script. It's all inside, and the bad guy is a wall. Great, let's do it.
It turns out it's a TV studio planet.
Right. Yeah.
Perfect. We could just stick it.
It's going to be slightly more expensive than the empath.
There's a. That made me instantly skip ahead to the closing credits montage on this. I was watching it with my son and he was like, "What's that?" I'm like, "Oh, that's Spock from this from earlier in this episode." I'm like, and there's Mirror Spock and there's a tiger, and then it's ancient Greece, which is a whole. We'll have to talk about that later. And it was just a confusing bunch of stuff. I think they ended on the tiger actually, but. Yeah, I don't know. The first two things are things from Star Trek, and then it's like, oh, and here's some other cheap stuff that they could mix in here.
Stock footage we happened to include in an episode once.
Yeah.
Doesn't really stand on its own very well.
So we haven't really talked about the big problem. I mean, I think we should at least bring it up.
Oh, yeah.
The real big problem of this episode is that they're on a collision course with another planet.
Yeah.
That leads to McCoy's. My favorite line of McCoy's is Jim, I'm kind of on a collision course myself.
You know what? What he was about to say, I said that before he did. I swear to God, it seemed like an inevitable line for him to say.
It's the kind of thing where you're like, don't say it. Oh, he said it.
I'm going to say it the next time I badly have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
I was more like Bart didn't do it scene in the classroom. I was like, say it, Bones.
Say the line.
I'm on a collision course myself. Yeah.
But yeah, it is a weird, you would think that they, we can almost, especially one that's not going to be here for a year, us now with our technology, we can kind of hopefully deflect an asteroid to at least, just clear the planet.
Couldn't they just detonate a photon torpedo, close enough to it to deviate its course? Like the
tractor beams,
the slightest change in its trajectory over a year's time would be surely miss a planet.
Yeah,
So it is sort of like they haven't thought this through quite far enough. Of course, those are kind of things that maybe in 2021 understanding of space, not so much 1968 understanding of space. So At least not meaning that NASA would have understood. I'm sure some NASA guys were watching this episode. Yeah, well, they could have just done this. but people watching TV would not. Would they be like, huh?
Yeah.
Would that even work? Why is this episode so boring? You know, so.
Along those same lines here, let's talk about 1968's understanding of space. Once they, again, skipping ahead, once they deactivate the why do I keep wanting to call it an icon? The
Oracle.
Oracle. They deactivate the Oracle. They go inside. And for a second, I was like, oh, wait a minute. Which came first, this or 2001? Because they go into the computer control room and it's all red and they're like deactivating things. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it turns out this was produced a couple months after 2001 came out in theaters.
So
2001 was April, and this was, I think this started filming in July or something like that.
Well, there you go. That's interesting.
Like, absolutely. They're like, oh, you know what we should do? You guys seen 2001? Yeah, of course we've seen 2001. Work on a space show. I dug that they were kind of, it was very much like a poor man's, Hal's brain center there.
Mm-hmm. Because Spock immediately finds the heat. So I actually dug another season 3 low budget effect, but I really liked was the, I liked it when it went red, heat red.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of cool looking in that lo-fi sort of way. And I thought, okay, well, they don't just, it's better than them just saying the temperature's rising and acting like they're sweating. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
And I like their lo-fi electrocution effect or whatever it was. Them getting zapped, space zapped. It's weird. They get clearly like otherworldly space zapped, and then Spock refers to it as being electrocuted. Like, McCoy must have gotten a stronger electric shock. Oh, is that what that was? Right. That's what electricity
into,
looks like.
Paper dolls, like cutouts.
Yeah, it's cool.
But I like it too, yeah.
I don't know. I like the effect more than I like, Spock standing there shouting the temperature repeatedly, because I'm like, that's not helping anybody.
I agree. Leave that out. It's just getting really hot in here.
Right.
Yeah.
So take off all your clothes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why that... not even a fan of Nelly, but whatever.
But It did make me think that also, like, but they're obviously using Fahrenheit here, right? That's what it's not.
It's not Kelvin.
No, it is not.
That's why Tom likes it.
Uh huh.
Tom.
There's another. So near the end, when she kind of like, she goes in to kind of confront the Oracle. Natella goes to confront the Oracle. There's a I wrote down alternative truths, because remember that whole thing where there's she's saying like, hey, like that, you know, they told me that this
wasn't
was gonna
real.
Happen.
That and wasn't like, even real.
And they were like, yeah, that the Oracle is just like, no, like they're what they said is wrong. The only, you know, I'm right. And I'm like, well, but what they said is, you know, this part is true and I can see this happening. And they're like, no, well, listen to me. And I was like, yeah, we went through this whole thing with alternative truths. And that was so like, how did anybody buy that? Not to get too political, but it's just like, yes, no, this alternative truth is such a dystopian, like, nonsense concept.
Double
and here,
speak.
They're poking fun at that kind of a thing here in
1968.
We saw that this was, you know,
it's like we've been warned.
Mind control nonsense. And
first of all, they change it to alternative facts. So that threw everybody for a loop.
Right. Yeah. That's what I meant. They don't say alternative truths in here. I meant.
And also, Kellyanne Conway is just extremely persuasive and charismatic, except for the fact that she's neither persuasive or charismatic.
Sorry,
all you Kellyanne Conway stans out there, but had to be said.
It's true. In a genuine truth sense.
Sort of true.
I forgot where I was going from there, other than getting upset at I was trying to think of what's the parable here? What are they mainly kind of, you know, going after? Because it's not always, you know, like a one-to-one thing, but it does seem a little bit like a couple of times I got a, you know, oh, they're poking fun at, not poking fun, but kind of poking, trying to take down religion a bit. But then also there's political kind of bent to it. And I guess it's just, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other, but the kind of that whole like indoctrination, like once McCoy agreed to marry her and he had to go through, like he had to basically convert, it mm-hmm. seemed very religious, mm-hmm. The whole society. But then,
and they
also
do have a book, they have a sacred text, like yeah. it's hard not to see that a certain way. Yeah,
what do you mean, Tom?
I'm just saying, like, you know, all the cockamamie ideas in the world are in, but no, come on.
Hey, speaking of the book, that's the same, that's Chicago Gangsters of the 20s or whatever. Yeah.
The book. Stop talking about the book. I don't want any more cracks about the book. Speaking of religions and ruining civilizations and stuff, how do we feel about their, you know, they kind of say like, well, yeah, this is kind of, they bring up the prime directive. They're like, I don't know if we should be doing this. The prime directive. And Kirk's like, okay, but if we do nothing, you know, all these people will die and everybody on that planet that they're going to hit is going to die. And that was enough for me. I was kind of like, all right, yeah, you should absolutely violate the prime directive right now. Everybody's in a pickle.
You're always saying that, Tom.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, let's violate the prime directive. Like, Tom, it's like Thursday night at 10 o'clock. What's like, no,
come
nobody,
on. You guys
don't
know. We're
just
how to
getting
live.
Ice cream.
Yeah.
we'll show them our technology is going to be great. Let's go.
You guys want to go to the city, violate the prime directive?
One thing about the prime directive is, though, if an entire culture is basically imprisoned by a concept or in any other way imprisoned and enslaved, doesn't that automatically toss out the prime directive? Do you actually respect slavers?
Are they happy?
I don't know.
I think you're supposed to. I mean, there are plenty of like Next Generation episodes where they have this exact debate where they're like, you know, is the prime directive more important than the fact that all these people are suffering or enslaved or whatever they are? And the show's, I don't know. I was going to say the show stance seems to be like, well, no, hey, the prime directive is the prime directive. It's there for a reason. I actually don't even, what is the reason for the prime directive, by the way? And the do we know why they introduced that into the show?
Because they're not colonists. They're not supposed to be colonizers,
right.
You know?
Right.
But being a colonizer and being an emancipator are two different things.
Yeah.
Now, you can use emancipation to colonize, which, that's been done a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you are the Federation, you should say, we are not colonizers, but we can be emancipators mm-hmm. and then help them set up their society from there without colonizing them. You don't have to be a colonizer. That's just a malicious. That's if you have malicious intent. The Federation is not. So to me, it's like once you reach the planet and there's empirical evidence of enslavement under whatever circumstances, prime directive's out, if you ask me. And especially mm-hmm. if you're making a Star Trek show now, I'd love to see them get away with an episode where there's some slave culture and they ignore that in 2021 for some prime directive and see how Twitter reacts to
that. Right, right.
Because it's going to be like, this day and age, we believe in the righteousness. Like, I just watched an entire television show about John Brown, right? Great mm-hmm. show called The Good Lord Bird. John Brown, real complicated guy to think about. He pulled people out of their homes and beheaded them.
True.
He was freeing slaves. His entire intent was to free slaves. So we can make a show about that, and we're entirely sympathetic towards this guy, even though his means are pretty rough, you know, especially for the time we live in. Yeah. But we're going to side with the guy. If his intention is righteous, we're going to side with the guy that frees the slaves. Therefore, the Prime Directive probably needs that. There needs to be a proclamation in there. Under these circumstances, kick this thing out.
I want to walk back my earlier, when you said like, oh, they're enslaved. I'm like, why are they happy? I didn't mean enslaved people enslaved by other people. I was talking in this specific instance or in like other, a lot of Star Trek, you know, original series, especially they're like, oh, like everything's great, except they don't have free will or full control over their destinies. Right.
Those poor people in the apple.
Crux. Yeah. Like that's a different, if somebody's actively being enslaved by others and, you know, forcing others to bend to their will, that's a whole different ball of wax that I,
and then in this particular case, they're slaves to a huge misunderstanding, right? This is like Three's Company, Atomic Three's Company, right? There's a big misunderstanding that happened ages ago. It's absolute fact. They absolutely, this isn't in question. They are living under an illusion. I think you can shake them out of the illusion. I do not think it's unethical to take somebody and say, there is, you are not, this is not a planet. This is a spaceship. There is space out there. Those, you know.
Yeah.
And then if you're not allowed to go to the surface to find this out for yourself, that's also a big problem. So even if it's a machine that went haywire at some point, it's also a form of enslavement. To me,
I can imagine that part of the thinking behind the Prime Directive is like, oh, okay, we're just because we're traveling through space doesn't mean that we have all the right answers. And like, how are we going to? It's kind of like a blanket, like, let's just not, don't touch it because we're probably going to do more harm than good. Like, just takes all kinds of critters to make Farmer Vincent fritters, and there's all sorts of people out here, and they're all doing their own things in their own ways, and we should just let them figure it out without playing God or anything.
It's a safeguard against manifest destiny is what it is. It's, okay, the arrogance of the technologically, in this case, technologically superior culture.
Right.
We got a safeguard against that. That's not, that happened on Earth, and entire cultures were devastated, genocide happened, so on. Yeah. We're not going to do that. But on Earth, if we go to a country, like ostensibly, where there's some tyrant, that's enslaving his entire culture and committing genocide. We want to take that person out of there, don't we?
Or a disease that they can't fight.
I think that's righteous.
Well, it depends upon whether he's strategically located or has resources.
Again, that's a little different. Now, that's where the malicious intent comes in. That's where the reality sets in. I'm giving the idyllic. I'm going from the idyllic point of view.
If
America really was what we thought it was when we were kids and what it's supposed to be, then that's what we would do things for to save. That's why we allow genocides to take place, but we knock out rulers that are in countries that are actually probably fairly doing okay compared to those other places just because of the oil and such.
Yeah.
We are getting political in this episode.
Joe just made me think of like, what if, so like, remember there's the point. When they get, McCoy says he's going to stay. Kirk has to call up Starfleet, and Starfleet's like, hey, like, just leave it alone. We'll handle it from here. Like, maybe that's because maybe the situation on Darren 5 was less than ideal, and they were like, well, conveniently, a giant asteroid is going to come and knock this out. That's going to solve our problems for
us. Yikes, Pete. So,
I think Starfleet should have been conniving. Maybe that's why they were just like, yeah, back off for a little bit. Oh, Darren 5, huh?
Right. Yeah. It could either be that, or it could be like, we're going to make the hard call and blow the thing up. You know, like, we got to save all the people on Darren 5 or whatever.
Ben Grimm up.
Yeah. Sorry. It had to happen sometime.
The whole thing, not just like his foot.
The entire thing.
But I also think, like, along those same lines, so instead of interfering, why not just, like, leave and then, like, beam back in directly to the control room?
Yeah.
While nobody's looking, just like beam in and be like, doo-doo-doo-doo, fix the tubes, you know, like set it back on course and then leave again and be like, yep, no, we were never here. Yeah. And also maybe like doing the like, fix the tubes and also like turn down the violence against your followers here. Like make it not so zappy.
Get in the book, scribble some stuff out. Yeah.
Those Bill Gates devices are out. You cannot let a culture do that to people. Yeah. I think there's no fixing that. I think once you find out that there's a device implanted in someone's head, and if they speak of the truth, they die.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I say there's no going back from that.
But see, that's the thing. Like, is the idea that those things were implanted and the whole secrecy thing was just to keep everybody happy and not questioning stuff until they got where they were going, and then maybe those things would be deactivated and everything would be cool.
Funny. Yeah, because you just made me imagine a funny scenario where it's like these people are walking around, they have this thing, and it's like, well, they don't know the truth, but they're doing okay. And you take it out, and they're just like, oh my God, are we just on an asteroid right now? Are you
it
kidding?
It stinks in here.
Absolutely.
We've been smelling each other's farts for 10,000 years.
There's also literally nothing to do. I have not seen one recreational thing.
That's an element of this that I thought was actually kind of weirdly, like, kind of funny and touching. The way that she, Nutella, I forget her name again already. When she's taught, she's basically wooing McCoy, and she's like, oh, isn't you know, part of the joy of men and women meeting, like the joy of learning about them, getting. I'm like, wow. This is a new guy. McCoy is like a new, there's never been a new guy before, and she gets to hang out with him, and she must be like over the moon in love with this guy just because he's brand new.
And she got that's to him true. First. That's the whole thing. She's like,
she's got dibs.
Are there other women? I'm trying to remember if there are any other women in this whole show. I remember a lot of male Yurnadas.
There are a couple, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably. The thing about you're not as a woman.
Wait,
that's right.
Acha.
I have the note here that I've never in my life had a woman come up to me and A, asked if I had a girlfriend, and B, asked if I'd like to go out with her. Like within two sentences, which is basically what she does to McCoy. She sits him down and is like, oh, is there anybody in your life? He's like, no. She's like, Is there a woman for you?
That's the
Is there a woman? Now there is. All right,
cool. I got bad news for you, Tom. It's happened to everyone else. Literally everybody has had
that. Exactly what I was afraid you were going to say. Yeah. Damn it.
Yep. Sorry, I hate to tell you.
Just don't tell me those things from now on. I'm real sad now.
Well, I just freed you from, just emancipated you. From
Oh, thank you.
John, why is your temple blinking red?
What?
I do like the idea that they would get to the... They would get to their planet and then be like, all right, we're here. Open up the book. And they open up the book. And the book is basically like, fooled you. Like, it was like, oh, but like, none of wait.
Here's how to plant a tree.
I feel like I've seen that before.
The book is just,
Why does that sound like a familiar thing that I've seen in something before?
I don't know. But it's like, the book is like the truth.
You can't open the book.
It's just telling you, like, oh, everything that you've lived through just now is a lie. Yeah. Like, you've been on an asteroid, not a planet. Now we're at a new planet. Get off and go to the planet.
Now you're on a planet. Go learn some farming.
And then it's like, well, why do I trust you now? You just lied to me for like 30 generations.
I like the idea of them just opening. They open the book and confetti just like shoots out. Congratulations, you got to the end. That's all there was to it. Get from point A to point B.
No, I don't know. Go forth and multiply or something. I just said this point. We
really
were just engineers. We were just concerned about the part where it flies.
Yeah.
Well, have we exhausted the episode here? Is there anything else to talk about? Missing anything.
I do feel bad for Nutella when she finds, like, she does meet this brand new guy and she's in love with him and stuff, and then she's like, oh, by the way, I have 1 year to live. She's like, oh my god, you've gotta be goddamn kidding me. I just met a new person who's gonna die in a year. Oh well.
Yeah, wait, the fact that they keep coming back to a year too, it's like you have 1 year to live. Also, this asteroid is gonna hit this Darren 5 in about 368 days. Oh, we fixed it. Now it's gonna get to its new planet in 392 days. It's always just like right around, everything's happening right around the same time. And it's just like, oh, what's going on here?
It's mathematical precision of this episode. That's what it is.
The ending is a little bit like, I'm not sure what. Basically, is Kirk saying like, oh, hey, you want to go get some? Like at the end, he's just like, yeah, they're due to get to their new planet in about a year. Like, do you want to go thank them personally? You know, like that woman that you were going to marry. Yeah, do you want to go hang out with her and tell them thanks for curing your disease?
The joy of discovering each other. I actually really like. You know what? I had to know that I really like that ending because. Why wouldn't you? Like, just because, like, most TV episodes, they end like, well, that's the end of the story. We're never going back. That's it. But it's like, you know, McCoy met this woman. She met him. They like each other. They have the ability to travel to where they're going to be and say hi to each other and stuff. I don't know if they're going to get married or anything, but the why wouldn't you do that?
Well, yeah.
He's like his camp friend who's going to go see next year.
I'm always amazed at how many, like, you know, I before we started this project, I had a kind of certain... respect for you know, well, I still do, obviously, the makers of The Wrath of Khan for being like, oh man, look, they took that and just like ran with it. And I'm like, going back, well, as we do this, I'm like, oh, there's so many space seeds. So many of these episodes end with like, oh, you can do that and then see where that thread goes. Like, you know, this, you do same exact thing, you know, it's just like, oh, we just like launched a whole new civilization to a new planet. And like one of them was shtipping McCoy. Like, let's go back and see this planet, you know, like let's visit that in the future.
If only there was like a bunch of novels that dealt with the sequels to episodes to the show. Imagine what a rich vein that would be to tap.
That's true. I didn't even think to look like, there totally have to be things added on to this, right? Wait, look, in memory, World's Hollow and I have touched the sky in memory beta. Let's find out. Related media. That's our, Star Trek 8. It got blished, but I don't know if it got, did they follow it up with anything?
Let me
click on some of the characters while we talk here. Natira.
I do have one question that concerns a sequel, you know, a story down the road. are the kidney growing pills in the medical information that they get at the end of this episode.
Oh, easily. Yeah.
Yeah. They got to be, right. Like, I'm assuming that this is actually, they don't spend much time with it, but this is actually a massive advance in medical technology and understanding for the entire universe.
This is the library at Alexandria. What is it?
Alexandria.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think they are. I think that they found the recipe for the kidney growing pills is in this.
I think you're right. And transwarp drive, whatever that is.
Oh, man. Wait a minute. For the first time in a long time, I'm intrigued. I want to read a Star Trek novel.
Ooh.
Ex Machina by Christopher L. Bennett.
Domhnall Gleeson and Oscar Isaac.
Yeah. It's immediately post the motion picture.
Ooh, I like talking.
And it involves the Fabrini. And it's a sequel to this episode that immediately follows the motion picture. And so it's got V'ger and Darren Five. I kind of want to read this. And it only came out like in 2005, maybe. So it's not
it's got to be good.
Yeah, I'm interested now.
I like those books that are set around that time where you can still envision them wearing those uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the cover is beautiful. It's got Kirk in the terry cloth, like, and everything.
Ooh.
All right. I'm gonna immediately forget to read that as soon as this episode ends. But
right.
Everybody remind me. I want to read Ex Machina, the Star Trek book.
Well, speaking of the episode ending.
Yes. How are we doing here? What is it?
What do we think, guys?
What do we think about it? Oh, and what is it? Somebody the other day mentioned that I forgot what episode made them say it, but they were like, I need to add a bones category. I need to add like a medical, you know, sick bay category to my episode classification. And it's tough because it's not, you know, the episodes aren't, my classification isn't based around who the episode is based on, but there needs to be another. You know, the command episodes generally represent Kirk's ethos, his whole thing. If somebody else, so it could be somebody else doing it, but that Kirk kind of like bravado, that you know, decision command is represented by Kirk, and science is represented by Spock. But there is another, like these other kind of like a heart episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't
like
a
barracuda.
What? Mm. Yes, exactly.
Like a barracuda. It's a heart.
I
had a hard episode a few years ago, but give me some pills.
There you go.
But I don't have a classification for this, and that might be like what is a love episode?
When somebody besides Kirk gets laid.
Yeah.
How about that?
And so I guess we'll call it a bones. We have to add a new classification. Sorry to anybody who's created, really finite. Way to track my classifications on this. I'm going to screw it up.
You should always add to it, and then the thing should be like slightly unrelated. Some of them are like, well, this is a command episode because there's command. It's engineering because the episode itself needed to be fixed. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
That's why I like that they're
That's
all
That's what
like,
I've always been confused about. It seems like command and science are not judgment calls, they're more just like classifications, right. But engineering is like, well, actually the episode as an episode needs work or something.
Because it doesn't great, like no? If it doesn't fit neatly into one of those, because it doesn't know what it's doing, it needs work.
Yeah. Well, then so you do
it's got the raw materials, but it needs work to get into shape to be one of the other things.
Okay.
And then also there's a red shirt, which is just like this is just a mess.
But then I like that the bones is just a real juvenile one. It's just like if somebody gets laid. It's
love
it's a bones episode.
Yeah. Well, let's highbrow that up a little bit. It's a love episode.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Love Federation style.
Oh, yeah.
So looking back at it, what would Sitting on the Edge of Forever be? When Kirk actually legitimately falls in love, and it's not just like stepping his way in the stars.
Yeah.
Well, although it still is retroactively, it's a hard episode. Then.
But it still is a matter of command. Like he's got to make that hard decision to,
so to speak.
Yeah.
Jeez, we're really getting.
Yeah.
Wait, but he does. Yeah, he does.
It's tough. I don't know.
Oh, it's tough.
Luckily, we can't backtrack, so we don't have to make make that hard decision. But I'm instituting a new classification here, and it's a bones.
I'm sure it'll be just as popular as the other ones.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It'll make the whole thing even more popular.
How do we feel about it, though? How do we grade it? How do we feel about it quality-wise? I'm torn. I want to see, like, I have a formula for determining my grade, which basically involves your formula, your grade. So I don't want to go first.
I've been trying as we do, like, I always get influenced by you guys, whoever goes before me. And so I've been trying to just decide in my head, I haven't written it down or anything, but decide what it is to me without you guys interfering with my thought process, for crying out loud. I was totally into this one for like the first half or so. I was like, okay, good, solid science fiction idea. People on a generational spaceship and stuff. That's cool. Oh my gosh, Bones is dying. Oh my gosh, I loved all the stuff about Bones that he's like, you find out like, she's like, oh, has there ever been anybody? He's like, no, I've been really lonely my whole life. It's kind of
wait
Bones.
A minute. Were you like, married to a salt vampire?
Yeah, it didn't mean as much as you'd think it would. You know, it was a cold relationship. Mm. So I love that stuff, and I love when Spock finds out that McCoy is dying, and he just kind of has his hand on McCoy's shoulder, and that's enough to tell McCoy, like, oh, Spock knows. Spock's looking at me like 3 seconds longer than he should. He knows, and he's really worried, and he's really upset. I really love that. So there's a lot to really, really like in this episode. I do think it kind of falls apart at the... Not falls apart, but it gets confusing. Like, there's a lot of stuff that we've been picking at. I'm just going to say, all that is to say, B-.
That's what I was going to give it to, Tom. I'm going to give it a B-. It's got its problems. It's not by any means a perfect episode, but I think, funny enough, Pete, I really do think it's got a lot of heart. It actually does have this emotional center to it. I love Bones. I love that he's in crisis. I love that he falls in love. I like Nutella a lot, especially on a baguette.
Yeah. No, oh, I do not.
No,
like
I like
Nutella.
Pervert.
No.
I like her a lot. And that works. That's enough for me. I don't think it's perfectly put together, but it's enough for me that I felt B the whole time I was watching it. And I thought, well, it can't be a B. I don't think it's quite there, but B zone.
Yeah.
B minus the bones.
The bone zone. Zone
the bone zone.
What about you, Joe?
I need to grow up.
I'm going to be a little bit harder.
Hey,
on this episode, on this episode, it's a C- for me. I did not feel that it came together. It doesn't, for me personally, have a lot of like a kind of campy fun that saves a lot of episodes that plot wise are a little bit bad. I think there's like too much to be done in the episode. In terms of like, you know, McCoy's dying, McCoy falls in love, this planet, you know, plus we have the whole, you ought to know people, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
It just, like I said, it didn't form a cohesive narrative to me. And I was kind of a fan of the music in this episode, but like the costumes I found near offensively bad.
Well, it's funny because my algorithm to determine my grade was like, I think I liked it a little bit more than these guys. So I'll just see what they say and then up it a little bit. I might even go as high as a B-, but lo and behold, you two said B-. So I'm going to have to concur with you guys and go B-, because that's what I was like, you know, I do like it. It certainly has its problems that prevent it from being, you know, like a B or a B+, like stumbling over the cure for mesothelioma or whatever at the end is not
xenovasculitis.
that's a bit of a clunker, but like for the most part, I was engaged for that. And part of it could be, you know, lack of familiarity. Like, this isn't one that I've seen a million times. I'm like, oh yeah, like I mainly know this one for the title and not anything that happens in it. But I was like, oh, all right. Like, I'm interested in what happens here. I was engaged. So just like McCoy. All right. Well, that's where we're at. And I don't, I understand your criticism, Joe, and I don't.
Why?
I don't,
thank you.
I'm not saying you
every episode needs an outlier.
Yeah.
Well, I do
have a question for you real quick, Pete.
Sure.
Sorry if this is some kind of green room talk or anything, but I really need to know what day of the week are we going to be recording next week?
Well,
I'm not sure. I got to look at my schedule.
Well, something I wish I knew more of the poem so I could say something about it. Like, well, you're going to be full of grace because the next episode is going to be Friday's Child. So we only got two F's and we're hitting both of them. This was one. Hey. Next one is we close out the F's with Friday's Child,
pa-pow,
which confusingly will be on Tuesday. So join us Tuesday for Friday's Child. In the meantime,
so
you know,
we're
all the
recording
stuff
on Friday.
Well, it'll be Friday's Child, which I think is Saturday, right? It's the one that comes after Friday. Is that not?
Its birthday will be on Tuesday, but we'll celebrate it on Friday.
Exactly. Yeah. Friday's Child observed. We'll be on Tuesday.
You could say it like Marla Gibbs and speak, Friday, child. Sorry. I should not have done that. That's right.
No. We just, 227 just passed the other day.
And there's no place like home.
Follow us on the usual, you know, Twitter, ABCDTOS. We're the ABCDTOS briefing room on Facebook, which I've perhaps short-sightedly wandered back into Facebook for a bit. So I'm there talking about episodes every once in a while. Other than that, hopefully we'll see you here again Tuesday for Friday's Child on ABCDTOS. Pew-pew! Say some funny stuff, everybody.
Whee! Oh, funny.
No, right. That wasn't funny.
Act like the microphones are off.
Larry Cohen. No, that's just stuff, not funny stuff.
That's the stuff.
Yeah.